Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, remembering Blessed John Paul II's Jewish friend Jerzy Kluger, and a look back at the Second Vatican Ecumenical Council with Professor Norman Tanner. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. The year ended on a sad note, as we heard, of the death of a longtime friend of Blessed John Paul II, Jerzy Kluger. In a tribute to his memory, I'd like to bring you an archive interview with him dating back to the 1980s.
It was a long time ago, sometimes around 1925, 1926, in Valovice.
And in what circumstances?
We were just children, living very near one another.
You were at school with the Pope for
For 12 years.
12 years?
4 years of the elementary school, and then 8 years of the secondary school until the high school certificate in 1938.
What was the Pope like as a child?
Oh, he was a very, very nice boy. He was quite serious, but not too serious. He was the best in the class in practically all subjects, never studying too much, but sort of more intelligent than all the rest of us.
So he was a little bit of a leader in the class?
Yes, later on, definitely, when we get bigger and when we got older, got into the secondary school, then he was one of the leaders.
He had a lot of friends?
Yes, practically everybody was friendly with him, because he had that gift which not many people have, not to argue with anybody, but by the influence of his way to make them accept his line of thinking.
How did you address him? In any particular way? Did he have a nickname?
Yes, Karol was his name, and diminutive from it is Lolek, like my name is Jerzy, and they were calling me Jurek.
What did he like to do in his free time?
I mean, what we all like to do. That means the main thing was, of course, sport. He played good soccer as a goalkeeper.
He used to ski?
Later on, yes. When we were little, we didn't have any skis.
Yes. You know,
later on, we got skis. Then we were going skiing. But obviously, it was different kind of skiing than you might know today, because there was no lifts, and you had to walk for hours to have a 10 minutes run down, so it was a bit strenuous. But then also we had a little trampoline near to Vadovice on a little mountain there. And so after school, in the afternoon, instead of going long treks in the mountains, we're just going jumping.
The whole world knows of his love for the theatre. He loved acting, didn't he?
And that was his main hobby, let's put it that way. I mean, he was a born actor, also a born orator. You know, his speeches, his declamation of the poems, they were so much better than anybody else's. And then there was a dramatic society in Vadovice. So as soon as he got to certain age, let's say 13, 14, he already was an actor in there. You know, I wasn't taking part in any of that activity.
But you actually saw him on stage?
Oh, yes, obviously, every time.
Yes, and is there any particular occasion you can remember?
Yes, there were a few occasions, but, you know, you wouldn't know those dramas because they were typically, you know, Polish or by Fredro, Słowacki, which are unknown in the West. I don't think they were translated in any other language. And he was very, very good. Later on, he always played a leading part.
This figure as a leader comes out all the time.
Yes, of course. And then every time there was an occasion, you know, a national holiday or another, when some important guest came to school, somebody had to make a speech or somebody had to cite some poem, it was always him.
Did you ever meet his parents?
I don't remember very well his mother, because she died when we were still little. I remember very well his father, gentleman, quite elderly, because he was his son in late in his age, because he had a much older brother who died when we were about 11 or 12. The brother was a doctor, medical doctor, and was doing some research work in Bielsko, near to Wadowice, and contracted scarlatine.
Scarlet fever.
Yes, and died. It was a big tragedy, and, you know, he came only a few years after his mother died. And they were left in two of them, the father and the son. And father was then already retired from the Polish army, so he lived with his son there in that little flat too near to the church and was sacrificing his whole life to that boy.
How important do you think all these elements were into shaping his future as Pope?
Very important, especially the personality of his father. The father was a very intelligent person, had a very big culture. He had all his time free, of course, because he was retired. And he was writing sort of a history of the church in Poland. He was a deeply religious man and a very nice person. I was many times in their house. The father was always ready to help us in anything we need, telling us especially his side of the history when we were small boys, you know, in a very, very nice way. I remember him as an extremely pleasant, intelligent and cultural person.
So you often went there for meals, too?
Well, not for meals, no. There were two men, you know, they couldn't offer meals to anybody, you know, I mean, it's difficult. I went there, you know, I mean, in Poland, in Wadowice, really, when the weather was not very nice, it's not the weather like in Italy, so couldn't stay in the open. So we went either to his house or to my house, and in my house there were plenty of people, but in his was only the father.
Friendship survived over the years. Did you ever talk of the past, in particular the war years?
I mean, we don't talk very often about it. I mean, he, I suppose, wants to avoid this because, for me, those years are really very painful, those memories. I mean, I'm Jewish. And my father was the last president of the Jewish community in Wadowice. And during the war, we did a tremendous mistake that we went into the army, that means my father and myself, and my mother, and my sister, and the grandmother. They were left there. We thought that the Germans won't do anything to them because they're women. Instead, they all died in Auschwitz.
You were listening there to an archive interview dating back to the 1980s with longtime friend of Blessed John Paul II, the late Jerzy Kluger. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, let's join Professor Norman Tanner, a Jesuit who is currently Dean of Church History and Fine Arts of the Church at the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome. But he also happens to be author of a short history of the councils of the Church. So as we currently have a couple of anniversaries to remember connected to the last of these councils, the Second Ecumenical Vatican Council, in an effort to shine the spotlight on that epoch, I went round to the Gregorian University to interview this council expert. Father Norman Tanner, in your book, A Short History of the Councils of the Church, you say that when John XXIII announced on January 25th, 1959, less than 3 months after his election, that he wished to convoke a new ecumenical council, there was considerable surprise. Why, in a sense? Because, I mean, this was old hat discussion. His two predecessors, the See of Peter, had already discussed this at length. So it shouldn't have come as a surprise. I mean, a century had gone by since Vatican I.
That's right. Vatican I, which is principally known for the definition of papal infallibility in 1869-70, was incomplete. It was ended forcibly when Roman troops entered the city. But the Pope at the time, Pius IX, never formally concluded the council. It was postponed. So right the way through the early 20th century, there was a possibility that it would be reconvoked. And it's true that Pius XI, we know Pius XII considered, but rather privately and certainly not publicly, that Vatican I might be re-summoned. So when John XXIII was elected in October 1958, that sort of possibility was still there. But nevertheless, it came as a surprise when, as you said, in January 1959, only 3 months after he was elected, Pope John XXIII announced that there would be this council. I say this council because actually at that moment it wasn't quite clear whether it would be a new council or whether, as you indicated, it would be a continuation of Vatican I. However, John XXIII fairly quickly made it clear that Vatican II would be a new council and it would not be a formal continuation of Vatican I.
Am I right in saying that John XXIII was considered, in a sense, to be a conservative pope? So it was an unlikely gesture because of that.
Well, that's right. It certainly came as a surprise. John XXIII was, I think, 77 when he was elected, and you might say he was expected to be a caretaker pope. And this new initiative, that's right, certainly was not expected.
This year, the 25th of December, marks 50 years since John XXIII officially summoned the council to meet the following October. As you mentioned in your book on the history of the Catholic Church, the Apostolic Constitution, Humanae Salutis, outlined its aim. What was the aim exactly?
Yes, well, as you mentioned, although in January 1959, John XXIII indicated he wished to call this new council, but it was not till 1961 that the council was formally summoned. And he spoke in fairly general terms about renewing the church, both in terms of presentation of doctrine and in its moral life and discipline. So it was quite a general announcement of the council, and without entering into specifics. Aggiornamento was the word he used on occasion, but there was no huge doctrinal crisis which required the calling of a council, as happened in the early church with Nicaea or Chalcedon and so on. So that's correct that John XXIII announced the council without a clear programme.
You talked about aggiornamento for our listeners. That means renewal, no?
Renewal, yes. Well, aggiornamento literally means in Italian, giorno, aggiornamento, bringing up to date, bringing up to day. So it's updating.
How did the council eventually develop? John XXIII died in 1963, and Paul VI, who succeeded him, found himself spearheading a council that they say he would never have called.
Well, that's right. The council began officially on the 11th of October 1962. There were 70 documents prepared by the Roman Curia. John XXIII entrusted the preparation of the council to the 10 commissions, which were much influenced by the 10 congregations of the Roman Curia. And they prepared, following John XXIII's wishes, preparatory documents, and they numbered some 70 in total. Some were completely written out, others were in sketch. However, once the council began with approximately 2,500 bishops who were the core members of the council, these decrees, which had been prepared as drafts, were basically not accepted by the council. And so the council, the members of the council, had to begin almost all over again.
Why did this happen? Why weren't they accepted?
Well, there was a variety of reasons. We have 2,500 individuals here, and it is not right to try and categorize them too precisely, especially into conservatives or progressives. But anyway, they felt that these prepared documents, 70 fairly short documents, and that those the ones that they were able to see, as it were, that those had actually been prepared in draft, did not fit what they expected of the council. And John XXIII himself went along with this wish to start from scratch again. He did not insist on the council pushing through these prepared decrees. So the early days of the council, the early weeks, so it was summoned for this first session from 11th of October to the middle of December 1962. And initially the assumption was that the council would finish its work within those 10 weeks. But when the decrees that been prepared were found to be unacceptable to the bishops and other members of the council, the council had to begin rather all over again. And it soon became clear that this one session this one period of 10 weeks would not be sufficient. And so towards the end, John the 23rd, Pope, announced formally that there would be another session of 10 weeks in the following autumn of 1963.
You speak about some of the figures that emerged as being perhaps progressive or conservative. Well, you're very vague about that. But what I'd like to know is who some of the leading figures were that emerged from this council.
Well, there were leading figures, that's right. Well, I say some hesitation about conservatives and progressives, because of course the progressives, as we call them, who made up the majority, you might say, as the decrees came out, in many ways they were to consider themselves as conservatives. They wished the church to go back to its roots, to its early period, the early first 4 or 5 centuries of the church. So they were not happy with the idea that they were simply avant-garde. And likewise, the groups who were called the conservatives certainly did not see themselves as simply going backwards. They felt that the church, which had been given to them, given to us by Pius XII and so on, was the best way for the church to confront the challenges of the second half of the 20th century, and to change things radically would be dangerous and counterproductive.
But names?
Some names. Well, the four people who eventually, the four bishops, cardinals, who eventually had the greatest responsibility for guiding the council, Cardinals Leccaro and Dörfner and Swainens from Belgium. The fourth was Cardinal Agagianian from Armenia. They played a crucial role. Bishops were discreet, and they led as members of their countries, and often it was the primate of the country who was particularly influential. Obviously, the two popes played a crucial role, although discreetly they did not come to the sessions of the council, or very, very rarely, but both John the 23rd and his successor, who was elected in the summer of 1963 after John the 23rd passed to the next life, they played a very active and discreet role in the running of the council while allowing the council to have very considerable liberty to proceed in its own way. Amongst the leaders, very important were the theologians. So each bishop was allowed to bring a theologian with him, normally a priest, and also there were a number of others who were appointed more directly by the Pope. And certainly the three most influential theologians, periti they were called, experts, were the Dominican Yves Congar, the Jesuit Karl Rahner, both very well-known figures, of course, and also less well-known Monsignor Philips from Belgium, who was a crucial figure because he had the confidence of both the, what you might call, the progressives and the more conservatives. And he was a crucial figure in getting decrees, especially key documents, the decree on the church and other key decrees, making them acceptable to the more conservative minority. He was a skilled politician. He'd actually been a senator in the Belgium Senate before and joining the council, and he was a very skilled negotiator. Monsignor Philips had a stroke shortly after the ending of the council, and so after the council, he did not become the well-known figure that Congar and Rana became, and indeed had been before the council. So he is a more discreet member, but undoubtedly one of the three most influential of the periti theologians.
A worldwide representation like this had never been seen before in the history of the Catholic Church. But how balanced was it, really? I mean, most of these people came from Europe, no? Most of these theologians are bishops.
Certainly it was the most worldwide by a good deal. So Vatican I, the first, or even Trench, you might say, with representatives, but Vatican I, bishops from all over the world, but nevertheless, most of those from outside the Western world were of European descent, so either directly of European descent or European missionaries. 700 altogether, some 750 altogether at Vatican I, whereas we have 2,500 bishops at Vatican II. Well, it's true, certainly the early initiatives in the council came from bishops and theologians, the ones I've just mentioned, really, predominantly, overwhelmingly, from northwestern Europe. that is to say France and Germany and Belgium, the Netherlands, and also Italy paid its contribution in that way. So for the first 2 years of the council eventually went on for 4 years, that is true. But nevertheless, we have indigenous bishops from the rest of the world for the first time, so Africans, Asians, Indians, and so on. And particularly, you might say, during the first 2 years, they gained their confidence, and undoubtedly they played an active and formative role in the council, especially from the second, third, fourth years. We might think of the African cardinals, Zoa, Maluba, if I get the name right, and as well as bishops from Indonesia and India and, of course, South America and so on. So the wider world bishops and also theologians from those countries, but particularly the bishops, played a significant part in the determining of the final 16 documents which eventually emerged from the council.
So from what you're saying, the universality of the church was visible for the first time in history in a council like this. But you spoke about the role of the papacy. If you had to put a stamp on Vatican II, would it be more John the 23rd or more Paul the VI?
Well, surely the council was called, and as we said at the beginning, to the surprise of many, by John the 23rd. So his stamp, particularly you might say, in allowing the council to have freedom and to move on from the decrees which had been prepared to new ones. Also in the sense that John the 23rd always wanted it to be a pastoral council, a council which would make the Christian message relevant to the second half of the 20th century, aggiornamento in that sense. Also, the last of the 16 documents to be approved, the Gaudium et Spes, the Church in the Modern World, that indirectly very much followed his wish that the council should be a pastoral one, one which would proclaim the Christian message in the language of the second half of the 20th century. So John 23rd, undoubtedly very important, crucial. Equally, Pope Paul VI, who was elected in the summer of 63, following the death of John the 23rd, played a crucial and extremely skillful role in bringing the council to a successful conclusion. So when John the 23rd passed, the council, you might say, was in some confusion. The prepared decrees had been turned down, and although there was beginning to think about the new decrees, they were in no way in final shape. So Paul the VI had this very difficult task of taking over from where the council was left, and with great astuteness and skill, he not only presided over the second session in the autumn of 1963, but then allowed the council to have two more 10-week sessions in the autumns of 64 and 65, and with great skill managed to bring the council to a successful conclusion at the end of that fourth period in the autumn of 1965 with the 16 decrees. So it was indeed a monumental achievement on the part of both popes.
In your opinion, with hindsight, have the decrees that went beyond Christianity and the Catholic Church been more influential than those that affect Christianity?
I think both. The council undoubtedly initially was thought to be mainly about the organization of the church within and broadening Vatican I into a consideration of the Church, the Catholic Church in particular. And we have that clearly in the core document, Lumen Gentium, which fills out what Vatican I had begun. But then undoubtedly the Council is extremely important because it went on first to speak in a very positive way, as well as acknowledging the difficulties, the other Christian churches, other Christian communities. And then, of course, went beyond that to, in its decree on non-Christian religions, a very short document, but nevertheless one which spoke in a positive way about the other great world religions, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam in particular. So that was a very significant, important a development and a change of, or development at any rate, change of atmosphere of Catholics towards other religions. And finally, I think very important, Gaudium et Spes, the final document, which we've already mentioned, Church in the Modern World, explicitly addressed itself to all people in the world, everybody, and that too was a new development for a decree of an ecumenical council to have a whole document, a substantial document, which was directed to the world at large, to the whole human population.
The whole idea of the Second Vatican Council was forward-looking, yet its legacy doesn't seem to be very visible today. Would you agree?
Well, I think all the councils, and we know we have 21 ecumenical councils, all of them were forward-looking. Many of them had to deal with a particular issue of the time, maybe a crisis, but certainly they were all there to help the Church into the future. But that's true, that's right. I think Vatican II in a particular way, and the Gaudium et Spes, the last decree, but all of them were trying not only to bring the Church up to date in the 1960s, as it were, but to help the Church into the immediate future. But you're also right, that's right, that it was a council which proved to be difficult to receive. Reception is the technical word, yes, reception. And nevertheless, perhaps we should not be too surprised about that. All the councils, I've mentioned 21, we might have five or six exceptionally important. We think of Nicaea I in the 4th century, Chalcedon in the 5th, the great medieval council, Lateran IV and Trent. All of them, well, at least the first two anyway, in the early church, they had difficult receptions. And so there's nothing to be surprised that the reception of Vatican II has taken time to be digested, although perhaps I agree that it's a bit disappointing that it's proved more difficult than one might have wished, because the decrees, if you look at the voting, had the overwhelming support of the bishops, even though obviously some had reservations about certain aspects, but nevertheless the voting was overwhelming. I suppose one of the problems was that the mechanism for putting the council into practice was not so immediate and direct as it would have been for certainly the medieval councils or Trent. Those councils, the medieval councils, were councils called by the papacy directly. There was, you might say, the papal mechanism for putting them into practice. Likewise with Trent, the papacy was fully behind Trent and indeed established a congregation of the Roman Curia explicitly for the interpretation of the council, so that if there were any difficulties, here was an organ which could resolve them. Those two councils had the very full backing of the papacy, the Roman Curia. I think Vatican II, surely the papacy gave its full support to the council. I think members of the Roman Curia, some of them, a significant number, would have been amongst the minority who had serious reservations about how the council might be going and its interpretation. So it's true that the council did not have the Curia, which was a crucial part, would find it more difficult to put some of the decrees into practice with full enthusiasm. So I think it's a combination of that, the Roman end, with justified, no doubt, reservations about what was going on. And then at the other end, the bishops, they had to do it sort of individually. And it's true that some of the interpretations or some of the practices were irresponsible, you might say. We know that a very large number of priests left the priesthood, same with religious orders. It was a difficult time after Vatican II, which had given great encouragement to many things, but then people would say, well, that it was leading to disintegration, etc. So the euphoria of Vatican II itself then had to face the realities of human life, human difficulties. But I would still like to repeat what I said just before, as it were, that two things really, that many of the big councils have had a difficult reception, difficult application, and so we shouldn't be surprised. And secondly, that despite the difficulties, the Vatican II has been behind so much of the movement in the Church since, and undoubtedly is a defining moment for the Church in the last century.
And warm thanks there to Jesuit Professor Norman Tanner. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Laudetur Jesus Christus.